Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's nothing quite as primal for a soldier than the need to return home. American troops have fought in far-flung battlefields across the globe, and sometimes they do not make it back. In fact, there are thousands of soldiers who simply disappeared into the haze of battle, their bodies never found.
Their remains, if there are any, are scattered in some of the most remote and inhospitable parts of the globe. But these are places where members of JPAC go. The Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command is an elite military division tasked with locating and recovering soldiers' remains. It is staffed by some of the world's top forensic archaeologists whose mission is to fulfill a promise at the heart of the military code, to bring all fallen soldiers home.
Brian Bender tells the story of two soldiers whose lives are tied together by JPAC. One, a World War II soldier. The other, a veteran of the Iraq War. Bender covers the Pentagon for the Boston Globe, and his new book about this issue is You Are Not Forgotten, the story of a lost World War II pilot and a 21st century soldier's mission to bring him home. Brian Bender joins us today from Washington. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Nice to be back.
It's great to have you. What a remarkable book. And I'd like to spend the first good part of our conversation sort of going deep into the personal stories of the two men who you essentially profile in this book. They are Major George Eyster V, who fought in Iraq, and Captain Ryan McCown, who fought in World War II. So let's start with Major Eyster. I was really taken by the fact that he is George Eyster V. Did all the previous Georges in his family also have careers in the military?
They did. In fact, Major Eyster comes from a long line of military officers dating back to the Revolution. His first American forebear actually was wounded at the Battle of Trenton in 1777. And fast forward to the 20th century, and he comes from a long line of George Eysters, mm-hmm. who are in that same family line, who have served in the first Iraq War, Vietnam, World War II, and the list goes on. So, yes, a very deep military pedigree.
Right. I mean, in fact, so deep that there's a little scene in the book where you describe that George Eyster, when he was young, you know, just what less than 10 years old, he's watching TV one day and he sees an image of his grandfather who had been shot in Vietnam.
Right. Lieutenant Colonel George Eyster III was a battalion commander, one of the most senior officers killed up until that time, early in the war, 1966. He was killed at the Battle of Kuchi, and that was captured on film by an AP crew that actually had been following his unit that day. So not just a big loss for the family, but to have it broadcast across the world and for George, the grandson, to see that as a kid, I think really did have a huge impression on him.
Yeah. And it's interesting because George Eyster, while he lives the life, the prototypical life, or stereotypical life, I should say, of an army brat, it's also clear in your writing about him that when he was a young boy and even, you know, into his teenage years, he wasn't so sure about joining the military himself.
Well, you know, when I first met Major Eyster, he kind of jokingly referred to himself as Lieutenant Dan, the sort of iconic character from Forrest Gump, who is also from a long line of military officers. But in some ways, Major Eyster is the anti-Lieutenant Dan in the sense that he did not relish the family business, as he would call it. He did not necessarily grow up thinking about going into the military and following his forefathers. And I think seeing the image of his grandfather killed in Vietnam, spending a lot of time with his grandmother growing up, who, of course, never quite got over losing her husband at 42, I think he had a little bit of a bitter taste in his mouth about the Army and about how it was a tough life, there were hardships. And I think he went into high school and even into college thinking that he would carve his own path.
Yeah, but eventually that path does carve or hew back towards the military because he joins the ROTC in Florida, right? And turns out to excel and becomes an Army officer, right?
He does. He joins ROTC fairly late in college, I think his junior year. And I think part of it was a sense that he was the last in this long line of military officers, and who was he to end this tradition? But I also get a sense that he felt a little bit like his father, who was also an Army officer, might have thought he couldn't do it, and he wanted to prove his father wrong. And, of course, he joins the Army in 1997 and throws himself into it.
Yeah, and there's just kind of a heartbreaking scene in the book where you write how George Eyster goes on to do Ranger training. I mean, the incredibly rigorous, difficult training to become go through the Ranger training. And he's like, what, just a few hours away from completing it? And he gets this heartbreaking phone call.
Yeah, he is just about 12 hours from completing Ranger training, which is this 45-day grueling process where he is told that his father has just dropped dead of a heart attack. And he's yanked out of Ranger training. He's literally in the Florida panhandle out in the middle of the swamps. And he is obviously brought home to his family, has to attend his father's funeral. And then he's told that he's got to start Ranger training all over again, even though he was almost completely done. The Army says, well, that's not good enough. You have to do it again. And that's a somewhat of a low point in the beginning of his Army career where he, again, had second thoughts about whether he wanted to do this. But, of course, he gets himself together after his father's death, very sudden death, mm-hmm. at 49 years old, and he goes through Ranger training a second time.
Yeah. You know, I'm asking you about these particular moments in George Eyster's life because it seems as if, his path towards and then into the military, there are obstacles that keep getting thrown up in his way, and yet he stays with it. And eventually, ends up, even though he's an Army officer, he ends up volunteering to work with a National Guard aviation squad and goes to Iraq in 2004 for a year.
Right. 2003, when the Iraq invasion began, George is actually posted in Korea. And one of the obstacles he ran into in the Army was that he wasn't very happy being a ground pounder, an infantry soldier. So he decides he's going to transfer to aviation and become a helicopter pilot. And so he does a couple tours in Korea so he can get a lot of flying time and catch up to his contemporaries. But he feels like he's missing the war or the wars post 9/11, like many of his fellow officers have by this point either been in Afghanistan or in the initial invasion of Iraq. So he hears word that a National Guard unit from New York is going to deploy to Iraq, and they need active duty officers to help get them trained, ready, and then deploy over to Iraq with them. So he goes at the end of 2004 for a year-long tour attached to a National Guard unit.
Mm, yeah, and I mean, 2004, 2005 are really tough years in Iraq with the insurgencies the instability across the country. What's the event or events? What essentially happens to George Eyster, Major George Eyster, that kind of leaves him very disillusioned about his time there?
Well, first of all, he arrives in Iraq late 2004, thinking he's going to fly helicopters because that's what he's trained to do, and instead, because he had been to Ranger School, because he had been a ground pounder before that, he is plucked out and told that they need him actually to go out with ground troops outside the wire, as they say, to be in charge of calling in some of the helicopter support for ground troops. So the first half a year he's there, he's out on patrol, is involved in several IED attacks, and obviously sees the war up close. Finally, the second half of his tour, he is back flying, and one of his best friends, close fellow pilot in his unit, is shot down over Bakuba in Iraq in 2005. That hits him very hard. And you get a sense from his emails and his letters home that when he goes into Iraq, at the beginning of that tour, he is confident that he's going to make a difference, that the U.S. military is going to make a difference and make Iraq a better place for the Iraqi people. And you see this over the course of a year, his outlook changes dramatically. Mm-hmm. He is disillusioned. He certainly probably has a touch of post-traumatic stress disorder. And by the end of that tour, he's really questioning, why is America there? Why is he there? And should he have gone this path? Should he have done what all of his forebears did? Because he doesn't really feel connected to it. And he really thinks he's going to get back home after Iraq and get out of the army.
Right. He's a man just burdened with so many difficult questions. So that's a sort of the nutshell story of George Eyster, the fifth, Major George Eyster, the fifth. We're going to come back to him in just in a couple minutes, because he ends up joining what Anthony and I mentioned earlier, the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, which is sort of where the heart of this story is. But Brian, tell us a little bit about Captain Ryan McCown, who fought in World War II. So we're reaching back in time here, but he's the other major figure in this story.
So Ryan McCown, his full name was Marion Ryan McCown Jr., is from Charleston, South Carolina, grows up really the man of the family. He is very devoted to his mother. He has two younger sisters. Their father effectively abandoned them when he was five and his sisters were 3 and 1. So he grows up really partial breadwinner, even in his teens, working part-time jobs to help his mother, who's a social worker, support the family and support his sisters. He loves airplanes. He gets a civilian's pilot's license before World War II while he's studying at Georgia Tech University. And Pearl Harbor comes December 7th, 1941, and he is pretty soon finding himself in a newly created Marine Corps fighter squadron, flies Corsairs, which was the most modern fighter plane of the time. And he is eventually posted to the South Pacific, where he flies a number of combat missions against the Japanese stronghold at a place called Rabaul, which is off of the island of New Guinea. And on January 20th, 1944, Ryan McCown goes off on another mission and never returns. Mm-hmm. And for 65 years, effectively, his family, most of whom knew him, passed away, but his extended family really doesn't know what happened to him other than he was missing over New Guinea, like so many others.
Right. So New Guinea is the place where the story of Captain Ryan McCown and Major General Eyster, the fifth, come together. Listeners, I'm speaking with Brian Bender. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, You Are Not Forgotten, the story of a lost World War II pilot and a 21st century soldier's mission to bring him home. So, Brian, first of all, tell us a little bit about JPAC, the group that that Major Eyster ends up joining after his service in Iraq, the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command. Their mission is to bring home whatever remains they can find of soldiers, of American soldiers, regardless of where they fought and fell.
JPAC is a relatively small command. It's about 400 people total. That includes military and civilians, as well as anthropologists and some of the civilian scientists. Its motto is, until they are home. And it has a fairly monumental task. Currently, there are roughly 80,000 American military personnel listed as missing in action. And that includes, as far back as World War II, through the Korean War, through Vietnam, up until modern day. And their task is to follow up effectively what are cold cases. And these could be aircraft losses, as in the case of Captain McCown, but many of them are battlefield losses, whether it was on the plains of Europe, on the islands of the South Pacific. A lot of their work is in Southeast Asia, in countries like Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, from the Vietnam War. Mm. And every day, they are peeling back the layers, following up new clues, sending recovery teams from the jungles to the snow-capped mountains of the Himalayas, where a lot of planes went down in World War II, trying to effectively excavate these battlefields in the search for whatever earthly remains could be found of these missing Americans so that they can be brought home, even if it's 70 years later.
I mean, you write how Major Eyster sort of reflects when he first joins JPAC after his service in Iraq, and he thinks to himself, you know, as a soldier, he was trained to basically destroy things, but here he is in an, you know, in a new assignment where his job is to put things back together.
Well, I think in a very unexpected way for Major Eyster, leaving Iraq and this grueling year that he had there, physically and emotionally, he arrives at JPAC, which is based in Hawaii and, of course, is a idyllic location for someone who's coming out of Iraq and wants to do something decidedly different. And he's struck by this dichotomy. He has been trained his whole life, his whole professional life, to be an instrument of destruction. And this is a job about putting the pieces back together, about bringing closure to these families. And I think in a way he did not expect, this new assignment was very therapeutic, not just for him, but for also many other men and women in the military who, like Major Eyster, serve in Iraq and Afghanistan and just happen to get assigned to JPAC as their next duty posting. Hmm. And so he comes out of Iraq really pretty down, pretty disillusioned, thinking about what he's going to do with the rest of his life. At this point, he's in his early 30s, and he arrives at JPAC and is thrust into this new world that he himself said he didn't even know existed for an active duty Army officer. And I think in the process, he reconnected with the military, reconnected with his family lineage. And in fact, when he got done with the assignment at JPAC, he volunteered for another tour in Afghanistan and will soon be a lieutenant colonel.
Wow. You know, so there's a he ends up leading a team that searches for the remains of Captain McCown in New Guinea. And it's actually not a place that has had as much focus or attention from JPAC as others, such as like Vietnam, Cambodia, Vietnam or Laos, for example, other places where George Eyster had gone. But so I'm wondering, you know, what were some of the particular challenges of searching for Captain McCown that the team faced in New Guinea?
Well, you're right. The major focus of JPAC has largely been Southeast Asia and losses from the Vietnam War. In fact, the mission itself really got going during the Vietnam War when, of course, some families believed that their loved ones might still be alive and be held captive by the North Vietnamese. But in more recent years, as technology has advanced, as forensic archaeology has advanced, JPAC has been able to close cases that for many decades they thought would never be solved. And New Guinea is a very interesting place because there are nearly 2,000 American military personnel missing in action, either on the main island of New Guinea or some of the outlying islands. And that is mainly because U.S. air forces were attacking these Japanese installations for much of the Pacific War, for pretty much 3 years. And many planes went down in the rainforest. Some were fighter planes, like in the case of Captain McCown. Others were bombers that could have had 10 or 12 guys on them. And most of these were seemingly lost forever. But in recent years, in a ironic twist of history, because mining companies, timber companies are effectively tearing down the rainforest, they are finding many of these crash sites, in many cases, which have not been touched in 70 years. So in terms of a forensic investigation, a crime scene, if you will, JPAC's anthropologists have more of an opportunity in New Guinea than they've had ever before, presuming these planes have not been disturbed and have not been moved by some of the natives or others. And that certainly is the case in some of these crashes. But in many of them, it's ripe for a recovery, as in the case of Captain McCown.
So a couple things were really interesting to me about when they actually were recovering the plane, or what was left of the plane, and Captain McCown's remains. That here's George Eyster, who had fought in Iraq and had actually, you know, done a lot of sort of house-to-house combat in Iraq, encountering civilians a lot, as sort of, you know, an active member of the U.S. military in a hot war zone. And then he's in New Guinea as an active member of the military, also interacting with civilians, but in a very, very different way. I mean, it's sort of the opposite end of that part of his experience that I found to be quite remarkable.
Well, I think one of the things very unique about this assignment, the Joint POW-MIA Command, is that in addition to the scientific piece of it and the historical piece of it, there is really this enormous responsibility that is handed to someone, like in this case, Major Eyster. He has to go into the rainforest of New Guinea, where tribal land is very sacred, where there are lots of different tribal customs, everything from black magic to you name it, this thicket of languages, tribes, clans, sects, and he has to negotiate with these tribal leaders at the outset in order to get permission to dig on their land.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of McCown's plane, they effectively marked off what they believed was the debris field of this crash and tore the rainforest down to the ground. And then grid by grid would sift through the earth looking for any sign, teeth, bones, dog tags, belt buckles, anything that would suggest the pilot they believed was flying this plane had come down with it. But in order to do that, he is constantly dealing with the local officials, the tribal leaders, making sure they're happy. In some cases, he would have his medic, who was part of the recovery team, set up a clinic for some of the surrounding villages to build goodwill. So it's very much, as you said, the opposite of almost what he's doing as a warrior in America's post 9/11 wars.
Brian, we've just got about 45 seconds to go here, and there's a point at which you write in the book that the members of the village in New Guinea who were there when they were recovering Captain McCown's remains recognized that George Eyster was taking part in his own sacred ritual of a kind, of the military's own sacred ritual of a kind. But in the couple seconds we have left, I'm wondering if you could just surmise for us, what was it about doing that you think gave George Eyster a sense that he found meaning once again in his military service?
I think these recovery missions are meaningful on two levels. One, bringing closure to these families after so many decades. But number two, it is a very clear symbol to men and women who serve in today's military who are doing this mission that if they go missing, someone will come looking for them.
Brian Bender is author of the new book, You Are Not Forgotten. Brian, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for sharing these stories with us.
Thanks for having me.
There's more Radio Boston in a moment. Stay with us.